yet embarrassed. Give me a hand, everybody.
Thanks, Marty. And Kevin, I want to give you a heads up. You're welcome to record this, but on recordings, I have kind of a country accent. I don't have that in person, but when you go back and listen to the recording, you're going to hear a little bit of an accent. So just want to give you a warning ahead of time. My name's Chad Payne. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since April the 2nd of 2003. And I'm sure grateful for that. And I'm a member. I'm actually, the flyer says that my home group is a group that I've never heard of in Seaside Park. But my home group is actually the primary purpose group. We meet on Wednesday nights at 7:30 on Zoom. And I'll be sure to get that information in the chat here sometime before we're all out of here. If any of you haven't been, you really ought to check this meeting out at least once. It's a big book study. We study the book very slowly, line by line, in great detail. And the thing that makes us a little bit different than most big book studies is that we try to keep our experience out of it and just discuss what the book is saying. And it's a whole lot more fun than it sounds like, but we really have a good time I've gotten such a better understanding of the book, which makes me really sound cool, which makes me much more effective at carrying this message and working with others. And I find that to be the most rewarding part of this path of recovery, is the ability to convey a clear message to someone who doesn't know what's wrong with them and doesn't know how to get better. So I'm really grateful for meetings like this, like Primary Purpose Group. And there are some people on here that I've learned a lot from, and I'm grateful for the people who have taught me how to more effectively do what this book is telling me to do and carry this message. Marty, thanks for asking me to come do this. I'll be honest with you, I don't speak a whole lot, but I do speak a little bit. And there are some groups that you go to and you're just like, all right, God, I'll do this one for you. You know, you called me to do it, I'll do it. But this one's a great honor. This one's really cool. And most really are, but this one's really cool. I know that I'm speaking to a group of people who love AA and love the big book and love our program of recovery in its original form. And that's what I'm interested in. And I like this group too, because, you know, some places I've been places before where they tell me that I'm trying to teach something, and I'm trying to be a teacher, and you know, I don't really take any offense to that, because I'm so grateful for the teachers that I've had in this program, and to get to teach some of the stuff that I've learned, share some of my experience, but not just my experience, also my knowledge that's been given so freely to me, to get to share that with a group of enthusiasts is a great honor. So I'm really grateful that you guys are here with me tonight. Now, here's the bad news. Marty asked me to do 60 minutes on step one. So what I'm going to tell you is this is 60 minutes of bad news. Like, step one is not good news. I mean, there's a little bit of relief in finally figuring out what's wrong with me, but it's disturbing. I mean, so many of us come in here and we know there's something wrong. And then when we really find out, I don't know how many times I've sat with a guy and really helped him to understand what it is that's wrong with him. Marty sent me a message that says 60 to 70 minutes. Okay, it's going to be a lot of bad news. I don't know how many times I've sat with a guy. And when I'm really breaking, and this happened to me, this very thing happened to me. And when I'm really breaking this thing down, explaining alcoholism based on my experience, and you just see this look on someone's face going, oh no. Because when I hear this stuff and I'm putting it up against my experience, the disturbing thing is I know it's true. I know it's true, and it's not good news. This is something that I've been trying to avoid, something I've been trying to deny, something I've been delusional about. And when I really start to hear it and it really hits me and I'm in that place where I'm able to listen, these are disturbing realizations. So on page 30 in the big book, it tells me what the first step in recovery is. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. So when it says we learned, well, who they're talking about there, the we, that's the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the people who were recovered alcoholics and members of AA, or what was becoming AA when this book was written. And here's what they learned. They learned that they had to fully concede. To concede means to surrender, to fully surrender to my innermost self. You want to know how you can tell if I've conceded to my innermost self? I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this before, but there have been times where I've worked with someone brand new and well, pretty much every time. And I've said, okay, so after hearing all that, are you willing to go to any length to get well? And what do they always say? They always say, yes, absolutely. And how many of them are truly willing to go to any length? Well, not all of them, that's for sure. So if you want to know if I've conceded or surrendered to my innermost self, don't listen to the words that are coming out of my mouth. Watch my feet. Then you're going to know. If you see me doing those things that I don't understand, that I don't want to do, but I'm consistently doing them anyway, then you'll know. You'll know that there's been a concession or a surrender there. So what is it that I am surrendering? What is it that I'm conceding to my innermost self? Well, it's that I'm alcoholic. I'm admitting that I'm alcoholic. That means a lot more than I thought it did in the beginning. And I heard Charlie describe it this way, and it fits my experience so well, because I'm not a person who was 12 stepped into AA. I showed up in AA and went to a lot of meetings before I was really 12 stepped. And someone really broke this down for me. So I sat in many AA meetings and said, my name's Chad, I'm alcoholic. And I knew that if there was such a thing as an alcoholic, I must be one. But I didn't really know what it meant. If you were to say, okay, Chad, so you're alcoholic, then tell me exactly what that means. Well, I would have told you my experience, and I would have expected you to say, oh, yeah, you're definitely one of us, because that's how I felt about it. But I didn't have a clear understanding. Why does that even matter? Because until I really understood what it means to be alcoholic, until I was 12-step by someone who's like me and who knew what he was doing and knew how to present this message, I wasn't willing to take these steps. I was that guy hanging around in AA, going to a meeting every night, chairing meetings and sitting on the committees and being a very active member of the fellowship and who was still very sick and carrying a message that wasn't helping anybody, sharing in every meeting. I'm sure you can imagine if you've heard me at Primary Purpose Group that I've always liked to talk a lot in this fellowship. And I was unwilling to work the steps of. I didn't think I needed to. And the reason I didn't think I needed to is because I didn't have a clear understanding of what it means to be alcoholic. I knew I had a drinking problem. I knew alcohol had caused a lot of problems in my life. But I didn't really understand what it means to be alcoholic. So hopefully, I know most of you already know, but for those of you who don't, hopefully by the time this meeting is over, you'll understand the difference in a drunk and an alcoholic. That's the main point that I want to get across tonight, because everybody knows what a drunk is, but not a lot of people. And to tell you the truth, not a lot of people in AA really know what an alcoholic is and really understand the hopelessness. So what does it mean then to be alcoholic? Well, let's talk first about what it doesn't mean. Here are some things that these are some common misunderstandings, and here's some things it doesn't mean. It does not mean that I drink all the time or that I drink more than anybody else. Some of us in here drank every day, couldn't go a day without it, but that's not the case for every alcoholic. Some of us drank more than anybody else. Just ask us, you know, we got to be proud of something. I mean, just hang around at the beginning or the end of the meeting and listen to AA members talk about their drinking. And, you know, I'm sure we the longer we stay sober, the worse it was in our own minds, you know. But that's not the case for all alcoholics. Some alcoholics were surrounded by drinkers who were drinking more than they were, but who may or may not have been alcoholic. Here's another thing it doesn't mean. Alcoholism does not necessarily mean that I'm weak-willed or that I have an addictive personality. Some of us are very strong-willed in every area of our lives, but it's not enough to keep us sober. When it comes to alcohol, our willpower is not enough. Some of us have that addictive personality that you hear people talk about. We take everything to the extreme. But then some of us do other things in moderation, except alcohol. Another thing it doesn't mean, alcoholism doesn't necessarily mean that I'm homeless, that I've been to jail, that I've lost everything, or any other specific consequences. And I think most people in AA understand this, but a lot of people in the world don't. A lot of folks coming in may think that, you know, I'm not alcoholic because I've never been in legal trouble. Some of us have been, a rap sheet a mile long, but some of us have never, you know, have never even been arrested. Some of us, you know, came into AA with we hadn't even missed a car payment, you know, I mean, we're all different in that respect. So if that's not what it means to be alcoholic, then what does it mean? So I'm going to read a couple of things out of the book, talk about them, and then share some of my experience with this. But the first thing that I like to talk about when I'm talking about what alcoholism is this alcohol problem. And I think that as sometimes the big book thumpers that I know, you know, my guys, my people, sometimes we're guilty of emphasizing too much that alcohol is not your problem. When you're talking to a new guy, he's thinking it damn sure is my problem. And I want to make sure that we're clear that, yes, if you're alcoholic, you do have an alcohol problem. And what is that? Well, the alcohol problem is the inability to control how much alcohol I drink once I start drinking. That's a problem. That's a problem with alcohol. Once I start drinking it, all bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen next. And I want to talk a little bit more about what that can look like. But and I think the common understanding of that is I go to the bar to have two drinks and then go home to be with the family. And I end up closing it down and maybe making it home, maybe not, but getting way drunker than I meant to get. And yes, it does absolutely mean that. But it can mean some other things, too. But I want to read something here back on page 30. It says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drink. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. That's bad news. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Dr. Silkworth describes it back on Roman numeral 28 in the doctor's opinion. He says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. When this was written, allergy was a pretty new word. I actually have a 1936 Webster's Dictionary, and it has a new word section in the beginning, and allergies in there. And basically what it says is an abnormal reaction, an abnormal physical reaction to a substance. So what he's saying here is that the action of alcohol on a chronic, not the guy who had a drinking problem for a few years and then got over it, but the chronic alcoholic, someone who has this for the rest of their lives, has this allergy, this abnormal reaction to alcohol. And how does it manifest? How does it show up? I mean, if you have an allergy, if you live in Austin, Texas, and you get cedar fever, that means you have an allergy to cedar pollen, or actually it's the ash juniper. It's the pollen from that tree. And how does it manifest? The eyes just are running and red and itchy, and it's terrible. And then the runny nose. You know what I'm talking about. But that's not how an allergy to alcohol manifests. That this allergy manifests in what he calls the phenomenon of craving. And all that means, guys, is once I put a drink in my body, one, two, maybe three drinks, now I develop a craving that is more important than anything else. Anything that stands in the way of me continuing to drink once that craving develops is going to get pushed to the side or gone around or avoided or run over or whatever in order for me to continue to drink. That's what the, I call it the alcohol problem. That's what the physical allergy looks like. And, you know, a story that I like to tell, and I recommend anyone who's you know, wanting to get out there and sponsor some people and carry this message, to have an understanding of each aspect of alcoholism, and then to have a story of your own personal experience to go with it. And one that I like to tell a lot is, you know, before things got really bad, I was still married and still had a home. And I had come home off a construction job. And at this time, my wife and I were getting along, which was rare. We didn't get along very often. And the reason is because when she got pregnant with our daughter, we both made a commitment that we were going to straighten up and be responsible. And she did, and I meant to. And that caused a lot of friction at home, as well it should have, because I was definitely not upholding my end of the deal. But on this night, we were getting along well. And we're watching a movie, and my daughter's maybe a year old or something, and she's playing in the floor. And my wife says, hey, I'm hungry. Why don't you go get us something to eat, and I'll put Abby to bed, and then when you get back, we'll finish this movie. It's like, great, I'll do it. I walked out the door. As I leaned back in, I said, I'll be back in 20 minutes, and left. You could have put a lie detector on me and said, Chet, you swear to God you'll be back in 20 minutes. And I would have said, yeah, I swear to God. And I would have passed with flying colors, because my every intention was to be back in 20 minutes. But as I'm going to get tacos, I get this thought. It says, you know, I've been off this job, and I got a pocket full of money, and I'd like to go hang out with my buddies. So tomorrow, when my wife goes to school, I'll get my daughter up and ready and spend some time with her, and then I'll take her to daycare, and then I'll go pick up my buddy Michael, and we'll go drink some beer and, you know, do something that involves a four-wheel drive pickup truck and guns and, you know, that's the kind of stuff we do in Oklahoma. So I go get the tacos, and on the way back, I have this thought. This is before I had a cell phone. I thought, well, I'll just swing by Michael's and let him know I'll be there tomorrow. So I go knock on the door, and he opens the door, and there's a party going on right now. He's like, Chad, come on in, man. I'm like, yeah, I'll come in for a second, but I got tacos. You know, I gotta get back home. And I come in, and then while I'm in there, I have a couple of drinks with no intention of doing anything different than what I said I was going to do. And then next thing I know, it's like midnight. And the first thought that comes in my mind at midnight is, oh no. Well, I can't go home now. Because if I go home now, I'll be in big trouble. So fast forward a little bit, and now it's starting to, the break of day is upon us. And I'm telling my buddy Michael, man, we got to get out of here. She's going to come looking for me, and things are going to get bad. Somebody's going to call the cops. You know, my daughter will be with her. I mean, it'll be a bad deal. So we leave, and my 20-minute trip to get tacos ends up taking about 2 weeks. And it's not like I come home in 2 weeks. It's like 2 weeks later I get caught sneaking my golf clubs out of the garage at like 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, so that's what it looks like when this allergy, this phenomenon of craving kicks in for me. But the part that I want to talk about here that's interesting is that thought that came into my mind at midnight. It said, you can't go home now. If you go home now, you'll be in big trouble. I've got a mind back here that when my body develops this craving, my mind is going to have to give me a reason not to go home. And the reason for that is because I know that if I go home, I'm not going to get to keep drinking. So it's like I've got this little voice back here that's saying, look, Chad, I don't care what you got to tell yourself. I don't care how you got to get out of this, but you do it, because we ain't going home. Because home means no more drinking, and we're not doing that. So I got to come up with something. And that idea that I can't go home now because I'll be in big trouble, for some people that doesn't make any sense, but there's some of you sitting out there who are going, makes sense to me. Yeah. That's the way we think. And what happens so often when this craving comes on me is it's like my plans change, not drastically, but a little bit at a time. It's just a change of plans. Yeah, I was going to have two, but I changed my mind. I think I'll have three. I'll stay 15 more minutes. Three, I'll have one more. I might as well round it up to five. You know, it's not like I go from I'm going to have two to I'm going to have 15. It just happens a little bit at a time. One more, one more, one more. So an alcohol problem. And there's one other thing I want to talk about on this that sometimes I've overlooked before. I didn't always say I was going to go out and have two. And then end up, there are many times I said, man, I'm getting wasted tonight. Let's get wasted. Let's get drunk. But here's the thing about that. On page 37, it says, in some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk. It goes on to say, but even in this type of beginning, we have to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. So the way that I understand that is this. There are many times where I've said, oh, I'm getting drunk tonight. But I didn't ever say, oh, man, I'm going to get drunk tonight and I'm going to totally lose control, and I'm going to flirt with my best friend's wife, and we're going to get in a fight. He's going to kick my ass, and they're going to throw me out of the bar. I'm going to peel out in the parking lot, hit a parked car, and the cops are going to pull me over and put me in jail, and I'm going to lose my job. The thing is there's a lack of control there, where even if I think, yeah, I'm going to get drunk, I'm thinking I'm going to get drunk and have a good time, but that ain't always what happens. Remember, I was sitting at the table with Mark Houston, and there was a guy who had Mark used to be really good at putting me in my place. I've always been a talker, and I've always tried to impress. And Mark was really good at seeing through my nonsense. And we're sitting at Charlie's table one night, and there was a guy in the meeting who had a sponsee who got caught drinking at a concert. And come to find out, he had been drinking on the weekends for like a year, and was the GSR at his home group, and was involved, and had all this going on. And I said, man, why would anybody do that? I can't imagine. I told those guys, I said, guys, I can tell you right now, if I drink, you're not going to see me. I'm out. And Mark said to me, he just kind of leaned over and said, well, that displays a level of control that I don't have. And I'm like, you know, he got me again. And that, but there, that illustrates such a good point. If I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I may be the guy hiding it in AA, you know, that everybody knows I'm drinking, but I'm telling them all, no, I'm not. I don't know why I smell this. But I don't know what's going to happen, you know, because I don't have any control. Okay, so here's the solution to a drinking problem. If you got a problem with alcohol, if you have a problem that when you say you're going to go have a couple of drinks, you end up getting wasted, suffering a bunch of consequences, I can solve your problem just like that. Ready? Here it is. Stop drinking. If you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I've heard that in many AA meetings early on. I don't hear it much anymore, but I used to hear it a lot. I used to hear people say, just don't drink no matter what. And that's great advice unless you're alcoholic. Because if you're alcoholic, you got another problem beyond this alcohol problem. And this is the one where it gets really interesting and really disturbing. As an alcoholic, I have an alcohol problem, but it's not my main problem. Here's my main problem. I'll read another passage here on the bottom of page 22. It says, we're equally positive that once this guy takes any alcohol into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it darn near impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So I got to ask myself here, does my experience confirm that once I start drinking, it's impossible for me to stop? Yes, it does. Okay, then it goes on to say these observations would be academic and pointless if I just wouldn't take the first drink. Just don't take the first drink and your problem is solved. You won't get drunk. Dr. Silkworth lines it out before page one. On Roman numeral 30, he says the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, if you're alcoholic, the phrase entire abstinence is probably pretty scary. But I don't know what it is about that. I just kind of shudder even today, 18 years sober, when I hear that. But it goes on here on page 23 to say, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So now what they're going to introduce here and really spend a lot of time discussing is this mental problem of the alcoholic. I don't want to offend anybody, but if you're alcoholic, you got two things going on here, a drinking problem and a mental problem. Let me explain it this way. If you've got an allergy to peanuts, I mean, that sucks for you because, like, peanut butter is really good. But I'm just telling you, you can't eat peanut butter anymore. Not even like Reese's or anything. Nothing with peanut butter. You don't get that. If you have an allergy to peanuts, it's pretty serious. Okay. So if you were to see someone who had had a serious allergic reaction to peanuts, you would say, my God, you have a serious peanut problem, because the symptoms of that problem are really, they're bad. But if you were to see someone have to go to the emergency room and get treated for an allergic reaction to peanuts and then get out and you go to their house the next day, you knock on the door, there's nobody, you go inside, you look, and then hiding back in the pantry with the light off, they've got a jar of peanut butter. You wouldn't say, wow, you have a serious peanut problem. You would say, bro, you're crazy. And there, that illustrates the insanity of the alcoholic. When it comes to alcohol, we are strangely insane in light of all the consequences, everything that's happened. Last time I went on a spree and the time before that and the time before that, I somehow pick up the first drink and I pick up that first drink sober. You can't blame that on the alcohol. The only thing you can blame that on is my insanity to take another run at this deal. And that's the part of this that's really hard to understand and really hard for most of us to accept. And if you look at the big book here, and if you look at, so let's just say that really the instructional part of the big book ends on page 103 at the end of the chapter, Working with Others. There's good stuff in the rest of those chapters, but we've been through the 12 steps in the first, say, if you count the doctor's opinion, say the first 110 pages of the book. So here we go. The first 110 pages or so of the book looks something like this. There it is. I don't know if you can see that? Okay. So up until page 44, the book is focused almost entirely on step one. That's about half of it. About half of the recovery portion of this text is focused on a clear understanding of what alcoholism is. And the reason for that is because it's hard to get this, because it's not like I'm going, no, please don't drink, and then I drink. It's not like that. There's processes that go on in my defective mind around alcohol that cause me to pick up another drink regardless of how bad it's been or how much of a desire I have not to do it, or how much of a commitment I've made. You know, there's something going on up here that's really hard to understand and really hard to spot, because the thing that I'm trying to understand it with is the thing that's defective. And that makes it really tough. On page 24 in the book, it says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Now, don't get me wrong. A desire to stop drinking is really important. It's just not enough to keep the alcoholic sober. A desire to stop drinking can be enough to keep a non-alcoholic with a drinking problem sober, but it's not enough to keep an alcoholic sober. It says, the fact is, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, they're saying, we don't really get it. But the fact is that most of us, most alcoholics, Bill always kind of tries to, you know, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but to kind of soft sell it. He's like, he's not trying to pronounce you alcoholic. He's just saying, see if this matches up to your experience. We've lost the power of choice in drink. So the alcohol problem says I've lost control, and the mental problem says I've lost the choice. This is the part that's hard to get. And it took me a while, and I argued with my sponsor. I'm so grateful that my first sponsor was, actually, I've had three sponsors in this program, and they've all been really patient. That's a requirement to sponsor me. But I'm so grateful that this first sponsor that I had was so patient, and he spent so much time with me discussing alcoholism, because I argued with him so much and said, that's ridiculous. I always made the choice to take the first drink. And then he would start pointing out things to me. He would say, describe your life to me again. The part where you didn't change clothes for 2 weeks because you were homeless and nobody would let you in their house to take a shower. Or describe the part to me where this daughter that you love so much, you could have gone home at any time to see her, but you wouldn't go home because you couldn't continue to drink the way you wanted to. Describe that to me again. And I would just, you know, it just took a long time for this to sink in, for me to finally realize that if I really had a choice, I would have chosen something different. And that was really hard for me to understand. And I'll give you an example of that based on my experience. I had a bad wreck 2 years before I got sober. I actually had the wreck on April the 1st of 2001, and my sobriety date's April the 2nd of 2003. So from this wreck, I drank for another 2 years, but I actually just kind of gave a spoiler to the story, but I'm sure you could all see it coming. On April Fool's Day of 2001, I was under the influence. I drove my truck off the left side of the road at about 70 miles an hour and hit a bodark tree. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the bodark tree, they're good for nothing but fence posts. I mean, they'll run a chainsaw. They're the hardest wood in the world, I think. They have big thorns that grow on them. I hit this tree. It was huge. At about 70 miles an hour, destroyed a big diesel four-wheel drive pickup truck. It took them an hour and a half to get me out of the truck. I spent a month in the hospital. My jaw was broken in three places. My shoulder was all messed up. I couldn't raise my arm. My hip was broken. My pelvis was broken. They did surgery on my hip. I spent about 6 months on crutches. My jaws were wired shut. I got out of the hospital, and I had, well, actually, while I was still in the hospital, my family showed up. My big dysfunctional family that loves me so much all showed up, all these different parts of my family. They showed up for me, and I know they loved me so much because I had pushed them all away and avoided them for so long, but they showed up there. They knew exactly why I had the wreck and exactly what kind of lifestyle I'd been living. And I sit with different members of the family at different times throughout that. And when I got out of the hospital, I remember sitting with my dad and telling him this, and he had a tear in his eye. And it's so hard to see because I had never seen him come anywhere close to crying. But I told everybody, I said, I'm done with this. I'm done with this lifestyle. I'm going to sober up, straighten up, and go on and fulfill my potential and be a good father and a good husband and go back to school and all these things, right? And I made this commitment and I meant it. I really meant it. I'd had enough. This had gone too far. And I was really going to change things, quit drinking and live right. So when I make a firm resolution to stop, I last 2 days. 2 days is how long I lasted. I was on a walker. I hadn't even graduated to crutches yet. My jaws were wired shut, and I was already staying out all night drinking and partying. 2 days is how long I last. And my wife took my daughter, and they finally left, which they should have long before, you know. And I for the next 2 years, I made many attempts to get sober. I made many promises to myself and other people, and I just kept picking up that first drink again and kept going on sprees and kept suffering more and more consequences and kept causing more and more damage and more harm to everybody around me, everybody that was unfortunate enough to love me throughout that process. And all that time, I was suffering from what the book calls the mental obsession. What is this obsession that the book talks about? It's mentioned on page 23. It says the obsession that somehow, someday they'll beat the game. It's mentioned again on page 30, where it just restates the same thing. It says the idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The obsession is the idea that I can control it. I've got a mind that says I can control it and a body that can't. And that's the plight of the alcoholic. And, you know, if you just have one of those problems, it kind of sucks. My little brother, you know, he started drinking in high school, and he drank, I don't know, like five times. And each time he would just get wasted and throw up on somebody, and they would take him home and drop him on the doorstep and knock on the door and leave, you know, the classic drop off your buddy while you're drinking in high school move. And after about five or six times, he said, man, I'm done with this. I'm not drinking anymore. And he's 34 now, and he hadn't drank since. So he has that problem, but he just quit drinking. My ex-wife, on the other hand, she has had a problem throughout her life where she says she's going to quit drinking, but she's not able to. So it's like every night she has a couple of glasses of wine, and she swears she's not going to do it the next night. And the next night she has a couple of glasses of wine, but she doesn't lose control and stay out for a week and not go to work and, you know, lose custody of her kids and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So either one of those problems is, it kind of sucks, but when you put those two problems together, that's a big deal. And problem one plus problem two, alcohol problem plus a mental problem equals alcoholic. That's what we all have in common. We can't control how much we drink, and we're not able to make this decision and stick with it to quit entirely. The obsession, though, it's really not fair, because I've got this thing that talks to me in my own voice that says, you don't have this. You can control it. And one of the things I really try to get across is how this obsession can be so tricky and so creative. I have, the way this obsession works, when I'm out there drinking, running full blast, all this voice, it's like this voice, all it has to say is, hey, Chad, let's get drunk. And I'm like, right on, let's do it. But then I suffer some consequences, things get really bad, and I swear off. But that voice still comes back and it says, hey, Chad, let's get drunk. And I say, nope, not getting drunk. I promised I wasn't going to do that anymore. So that voice has to get a little creative. Now it has to say, okay, you're right. We don't want that to happen again. But I mean, you can have a couple beers. I mean, come on. Just stay home. Don't drive. Have a couple of beers. And then just go to bed and it's all good. It'll just knock me, take the edge off. Like, okay. And then I'm off and running. Well, then I go to treatment or I show up at an AA meeting or something like that. And they tell me some things, right? And now that voice, it comes back and it says, hey, Chad, let's get drunk. Nope, not drinking anymore. Hey, but come on now, you're overreacting. Let's just have a couple beers. No. I have a physical allergy and one is too many, a thousand's never enough, you know? And so now that voice has to get a little more creative. Let me compare it to this. I've got a brother 3 years younger than me. When we were kids, I could get him to do anything I wanted. I could get him to do anything I wanted him to do. But there was a trick to it. I had to get him away from, I had to kind of get him off by himself and be really persistent. Right? Because if we were around family, people would say to me or say to him, Clint, look, just ignore your brother. You don't have to do what he says. So what I would have to do is wait till we were alone and then start talking him into it and be really persistent. And then I could get him to do whatever I want. Well, that's the way this voice works, this obsession, this alcoholism. It works like that. It starts off by saying, let's get drunk. Nope, not doing it. Okay, let's have a couple beers. No, I have physical allergy. Can't do that. Okay. All right. It's quiet for a minute. And then it starts to say things like this. It starts to say, hey, Chad, you don't have to tell your sponsor about that. You can handle that on your own. Or it'll say, you know, there's no reason to make all those amends. Let's just let bygones be bygones. Or I will start to justify a resentment. My mind or my obsession will tell me it's okay for me to be angry about this because after all, I'm the victim. Or it'll say, man, you don't need to sponsor as many people as that Chad Payne. He's ridiculous when he's, I don't even sponsor that many, but you know, you don't have to do all that stuff he's talking about. So what happens is this voice is trying to separate me from the program. It's trying to separate me from you. It's ultimately trying to separate me from God. And then when it gets me all alone, then it can start to talk about drinking. And eventually I'll give in. And that's the tricky part of this. There are so many people that in the Austin areas that I've so many of the new folks that are coming out of treatment. We have such great treatment centers around Austin that really get people into the big book and working the steps and hooked up with sponsors. And, you know, we have some great places, but there's such a misunderstanding. So often people coming out of these places and thinking that the obsession means I'm thinking about drinking. No, you don't always get that warning. I don't know how many people I've talked to that have had some time and who have relapsed, and you can ask people and talk to them and work with them and start asking them about this relapse and ask them this question. The day you drank, did you think that would be the day you relapse? And they almost always say no. Oh, I didn't think that. See, the obsession can be this little switch that flips back here where now I have a new thinking process that says I'm not a hopeless case. I don't have to do all the things they have to do. Maybe I am like other people. Maybe I got over this. Maybe the fact that I've been sober for 5 years is because I don't have this anymore. But it's very subtle and it's not conscious thought all the time. Sometimes it's kind of happening back here in the subconscious. I was doing this one time in a place and a guy said, why do you keep pointing at your neck? It's like, it's not my neck, man. It's the back of my mind. It's going on back here where you don't see it. And a lot of times that's where this obsession is working. It's back here in a place that I'm not aware of it. How do I keep that obsession from coming back? Well, it ain't rocket science, man. You just keep working a program. I mean, that's really the only reason we relapse. I can point my fingers at all these other things. You know, I lost this job, or had a breakup here, or things got too good, too many gifts, the gifts of whatever it may be. I don't care. Really, those are things that just I allow to pull me away from working the program. That's really the only reason that we relapse, in all my experience with all the people I've talked to and worked with. Okay, there's another piece of this that's really interesting that I want to talk about. It's this spiritual malady. And this is not, this is something that most alcoholics have in common. I believe it's to some degree or another. Not all of us relate to this 100%, but many of us do really relate strongly to this. And this spiritual malady is not exclusive to alcoholics. As a matter of fact, I think everybody in the world has this to some degree. Some people have it really bad, and most alcoholics have a pretty good case of it. But Dr. Silkworth, there's many places in the book that describe it. But Dr. Silkworth puts it this way. He's describing a sober alcoholic here. A sober alcoholic. Sober's better, right? I don't know. He says, they are restless, irritable, and discontent. Well, let's think about these words for just a second, because you can kind of just let this roll off the tongue. But sometimes those times that I quit drinking before I had this spiritual awakening, though, I would experience something like this. I would become restless. Like I don't know where I want to be, but it ain't here. You know, and if there are some new folks sitting in this meeting for one reason or another, you may be feeling this right now, and maybe even if you're not, but this idea that I'm restless means I'm just not okay with where I am and the way things are. I got to get out of here. I got to get out of this job, out of this stupid AA meeting. I got to get out of this treatment center. I got to get out of this town. I'm not okay where I'm at. I experience that when I get sober. Irritable. I mean, I don't necessarily feel like I don't feel irritable. I feel like I'm surrounded by idiots, you know, like I just don't like anybody around me. And I might even love you, and you know, but right now you're bugging me, really getting on my nerves. And discontented, that's the one that really gets me, because discontented, to me, it's like the world is gray. Like when I started drinking, the world changed to bright colors. I got out of this crazy mind because, guys, when I was like 12, 13, 14, something happened to me where I was not okay. And it happened gradually day after day after day where I was struggling, man. I was not okay with who I was. I was wishing I was somebody different. I was scared to talk to girls. I was getting picked on some in school, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I was just full of this tension and fear, and I just felt like I wasn't enough and I didn't fit in. And none of that was true, but that's the way that I felt. And then finally, a couple of years later, I had my first drink, and all that changed. All that changed when I would get a few drinks in me. I felt so much better. I was present. We were on equal terms here. It wasn't that I was afraid to talk to you. Now you were privileged to talk to me. I mean, life got so good. I remember my dad telling me, this drinking's getting out of hand. You gotta stop doing this and straighten up. And I remember thinking, dude, if you had any idea what you were asking of me, you wouldn't ask it. You don't understand what this has done for me. Now, when you take that away, restless and irritable, they suck, but that's nothing compared to discontented. All that's gone. Now I'm no longer present. I'm no longer a part of. I no longer fit in. Everything sucks. What am I going to do? Go to work, come home, watch the news, have dinner with the family, go to bed at 9. I mean, it's awful, right? But that's not the end of that sentence. It says that I'm restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience this sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. I can fix restless, irritable, and discontented like that. Get a couple drinks in me, and I am no longer restless. I don't care where I'm at. It's the place to be. I'm no longer irritable. I kind of start liking all you guys. I might even like buy you a drink or something, you know. I'll tell you my whole life story if you'll listen. And I am no longer discontented. The world is back in color and everything is okay. And all that stuff that I'm so remorseful about in the past, all that stuff that I'm so afraid of in the future has gotten really dim. And now I'm in the present moment. Told me when I went to that little treatment center, you need to learn how to live just for today. And I remember thinking, no, I don't. I've been living just for today ever since I took my first drink. I need to learn to start being a little bit concerned about what I've done and where I'm going, you know? But the thing is, alcohol did that for me. See, the thing is, for many of us, alcohol is really not the problem. If you're an alcoholic, alcohol may not be your problem. It may be your solution. And maybe that's why it's so hard to quit. See, it's not like I'm coming to you saying, let me take away this thing that's destroying your life. For a lot of us, it's like I'm coming to you saying, let me take away this thing that allows you to live in this world. And maybe it doesn't work for you anymore, but it's at one time for most of us, it worked really well. And maybe now it's the best answer I got, because I'll tell you one thing about it. The worse my life got, the worse I felt. But when I would get a few drinks in me, I wasn't thinking about that anymore. Then I made things worse. And I was in that cycle and my drinking kept making it worse. But my drinking was the only relief that I had from living with the pain that my life had become based on my drinking. And for a guy like me, you get a few drinks in me and I don't care anymore. And that's the closest thing that I had ever experienced to acceptance and peace is, man, I don't care. But what happens is we get in this terrible cycle the book talks about. And I've got this little, here, I'll hold up my iPad where you can see it. It's not really an iPad. But here's this terrible cycle. It starts with this first drink, and that kicks off this allergy or this craving. Then I go on a spree and suffer a lot of consequences. Then I feel all this remorse. Then I make a firm resolution to stop. The sober's better, right? But then I become restless, irritable, discontented, also known as a spiritual malady. Then the obsession kicks back in at some point along the way, and I don't even recognize it. And eventually, I think it's going to be okay. So I take that first drink, and I continue to live in that cycle, and that's my life. This is a hopeless condition. This is the bad news. Page 39 in the book says a really important point that's illustrated over and over in one story after another, and I'm not going to pull out all the parts of it, but it's summed up right here. It says, but the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Again, it's just not fair. You got this thing talking to you in your own voice. That's not fair. And now someone can explain all this to me. And now I understand me really well. Okay, I get it. I got this physical allergy, this mental obsession, the mental blank spots, the insanity, the alcoholic mind, the spiritual malady. I understand all that. Okay, I got this now. No. It's not enough. Self-knowledge is very important, because when I really understand my condition, that can drive me into doing this work. But it's not enough to keep me sober. Self-knowledge is not enough to keep me sober. It says I'm beyond human aid on page 24. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. That's not a good prognosis. So here's the deal. In step one, we're not trying to convince you that you have a problem. We've been knowing we had a problem for a long, long time. In step one, we're trying to convince you that you don't have an answer. I admitted for years I was a drunk, but to really understand what it means to be alcoholic and to really admit that means I'm clear that this is my life and all it's going to do is get worse and worse until I die of alcoholism and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. That's what it means to be alcoholic. On page 44, we just started this at Primary Purpose Group. We just read this last night. It says to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. So what we find out here, and I don't want to get too much into the next speaker's material, but what we find out here, is that here's a little spoiler alert. You know, if you don't want to know what's going to happen next week, don't listen to this part. But the only answer to this deal is a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. And it says here that I've got two alternatives as an alcoholic. One alternative is to die an alcoholic death. Okay, those of us that have been around recovery for a while and maybe before that, we know that an alcoholic death is very unpleasant. It's a hard way to die. And the worst thing about it is it might take a long time, you know? But it says here, that's just one of our alternatives. The other one is to live on a spiritual basis. Okay. Then it says those are hard for us to face. And we were studying this book one time and we did the same thing so many other people have done when they read this part of the book where they go, wait a minute. What do you mean these two alternatives? Or who has a hard time to say? Who goes, die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis? Let me think about it. I mean, why would anybody? And this guy that we were in there with said, you know what? It's because we know what it looks like to die an alcoholic death, but we don't know what it looks like to live on a spiritual basis, and we're afraid of the unknown. And I was like, okay, I get it. I'm afraid of the unknown. But I'm not that afraid of the unknown. Not enough that I'm willing to die an alcoholic death, and then it hit me. It's not that we don't know what it looks like to live on a spiritual basis. It's that we do know what it looks like, and we don't want to do it. Because living on a spiritual basis doesn't mean I say a prayer and I show up at church. Living on a spiritual basis means I got to tell the truth. I got to admit my deepest, darkest secrets to somebody. I got to go to all these AA meetings. I got to clean up the past. I got to pray and meditate every day. I got to keep looking at where I'm at fault. I got to sponsor people, even when it's inconvenient. I got to go to these treatment centers and jails and institutions and talk. I mean, this is going to take up a lot of time. There's a lot of stuff I got to do here that I don't want to do. So here's what we do. We go, die an alcoholic death? No. Live on a spiritual basis? No. I'm going to create alternative number three. And here's what alternative number three looks like. Any of you guys in here like chronic relapsers? Anybody been in and out quite a few times? It's okay. You don't have to raise your hand if you don't want to. I love when I do that in treatment centers. I'll ask people, you know, I do a lot of raise your hand things. And oh, I see a yellow hand coming up there, a virtual hand. They'll raise it. And then I'll always say, okay, raise your hand or I'll say, anybody out there, you don't raise your hand no matter what I say. And a couple hands will go up. I'm like, yeah, that's my people. I ain't raising my hand. Watch. He ain't going to tell me what to do. those of you that have relapsed a few times, been in and out of AA a few times, been back and forth to treatment a few times or whatever, see if this sounds familiar. I don't want to die an alcoholic death. I don't want to live on a spiritual basis. So I'm going to create a third alternative. And the third alternative is, when I get out of here, when I get this thing under control, I'm going to live my life. I'm going to get the family back, or I'm going to get a family, or I'm going to make some money, or I'm going to go out and do this, this and that and whatever, and have these hobbies, and I'm going to get physically fit, and I'm going to do all these different things that I'm going to do. And all that's good stuff, but that third alternative is not available for the alcoholic. Now, don't hear this wrong. We can do all those wonderful things. There are people sitting in this meeting right now and people in AA all over the world that have done all kinds. There's no limit to what we can do. As long as we put all those things underneath living on a spiritual basis, that has to come first. So when we talk about this current experience with step one, what I want to start to ask myself is, am I still clear today that whether or not I pray and meditate in the morning with the intention of developing conscious contact with the world of the spirit, do I understand, am I clear that that's tied into whether or not I drink? Am I clear that making every amends on that list is tied into whether or not I drink? Do I clearly understand that my life depends on working with others and carrying this message? Am I clear on that? Those are the kind of things that I need to be clear on, because a lot of times I get in this way of thinking, 18 years removed from my last drink, I get into this way of thinking that I do all these things because I enjoy the benefits. And that's true. I do enjoy the benefits of prayer and meditation. I do enjoy the benefits of being current on my amends. I do enjoy the benefits of writing inventory and gaining awareness and taking that stuff to God and having these character defects removed. I enjoy the benefits of being an AA member. I love to help others in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not the only reason I do it. I've got to stay clear and understand that I also do this stuff because alcohol is always an option for a guy like me if I'm not spiritually fit. I hear so many people say drinking's not an option today. I'll try not to use any bad language, Marty. It's not true if you're alcoholic. Stop working a program, and I promise you. I heard a guy in a meeting say, it ain't about drinking today. Well, until it is. And that's exactly right. So there's another thing that motivates me to continue to do this work 18 years removed from alcohol. So I'm going to talk about one more little thing here. And then you know, I kind of get on my little soapbox. But there's two. I've had this talk with a few guys here lately. And these are guys who are not drinking yet, but they've drifted away from AA. And maybe they can go a long time without drinking, and maybe it happened today and I just haven't heard about it yet. I don't know. But there's two reasons people drift. There's two reasons people drift and stop doing this work. One of those reasons is they don't really understand what it means to be alcoholic. They don't really understand the hopelessness of this illness. The second reason is they either don't believe or they forget, or somehow they think they don't have it anymore. And a lot of times that's not a conscious thought. But if you are clear on what alcoholism is, and you've conceded to your innermost self currently that you have it, well, then there's really no other choice but to work an AA program and be an active member of AA. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you.